Edmund White struck a chord for many in his 1982 book, A Boy's Own Story, when he described the perplexing rite of passage from boyhood to maturity. This fictional journey, which mirrored White's own Midwestern youth, brought him to the realization that he was gay. White's newest book, The Beautiful Room is Empty, picks up his story where the earlier book left off in prep school. It takes White through the often painful 1950s, a time when the word gay only meant jovial and lighthearted, and exhibiting homosexual feelings was considered an admission of mental illness. Ed White has also co-authored a new book of short stories which show the effects of AIDS on personal lives. It's titled The Darker Proof. White currently lives in France, where he writes for Vogue and other magazines. He's also written many other books, including novels and a journalistic look at gay America called States of Desire. I spoke with Edmund White from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him how sick he felt in the 1950s because he was gay.
Well, I think quite sick. I mean, in other words, I went to a psychiatrist in 1954 when I was 14, and he told my parents that I was unsalvageable, that I should be put in a mental hospital and they should throw the keys away.
And you took that in and believed it?
Oh, yes, I absolutely believed it, because in those days there were really only three possible definitions for homosexuality. You were either a sinner or a criminal or neurotic. And I think that if you were educated, you chose neurotic.
You know, I've heard people talk about those times, but I don't think I really got it until I read your book in all its detail. Did other gay men feel just like you did?
You know, the odd thing is I think that the more intellectual you thought you were, the more self-oppressive you were, in the sense that you have to remember in the Salem witch trials, it was the so-called educated people who believed in witches. The average people didn't think about it much. And I think in the same way that it was educated people who were able to take psychoanalysis and really turn it against themselves.
Did lesbians feel that way too, or was there a different sense about lesbians in the culture back then?
I think lesbians felt it too, but they were a little less visible. I mean, I think the thing is that our society tends to admire and reward slightly mannish women, not too mannish, but slightly mannish, whereas an effeminate man, for instance, is very much oppressed. I mean, if you were to walk into your bank even today and see a woman who is the officer of the bank and she had on a man-type suit, you'd be rather reassured, actually. Whereas if you walked in and saw a man wearing a dress who's supposed to be the vice president of your bank, you'd be quite alarmed. And I think that oftentimes, to the degree that our society is a sexist one and it admires men and looks down on women, I think that gay men are perceived as being more like women, and lesbians are perceived as being more like men. So in that sense, I think lesbians have oftentimes had fewer problems, but I think also being invisible is a problem itself. I think that gay men had to always deal with their oppression, which led to some sort of resolution, whereas lesbians oftentimes could pass, but that's a kind of suffering too.
Where did your sexual encounters take place in the 1950s, a lot of them?
In toilets, and that's what I write about in this book, The Beautiful Room is Empty, which was took a bit of doing for me, because even when I read these passages out loud, they make me blush. But I wanted to put all that down. I wanted to write about that world, because I think that it's still going on among people who haven't been able to come out. I mean, I think that there's a fairly small group of gay people in America. Then there's this vast group of people who are homosexual, but not, who wouldn't call themselves gay, in that they don't define themselves as gay. They don't know any other gay people. They don't go to gay bars. They don't dress like gay people. Oftentimes they're married men. And where they have their sex is in toilets, rest areas, or in little pornographic movie theaters.
And you still blush when you read those parts?
Well, I think I'm unusually retarded that way. I mean, even though I'm someone who wrote with somebody else The Joy of Gay Sex, and I've always been considered very outspoken, I think I've oftentimes acted ahead of my own feelings, because in real life I'm rather reserved, and sometimes an interviewer will come in assuming that I'm this terrific swinger, but but I'm actually fairly conservative.
And back in the 50s, when you were in these bathrooms, did you feel guilty every time?
Oh, yeah. I think so. And I think that's one reason why I was so compulsive, because I think that if there's a large part of your behavior that you don't acknowledge, in other words, you're leading a double life. I was a member of a fraternity, and none of my fraternity brothers knew about these activities. Actually, none of my gay friends knew about them. And to this day, people who are reading this book now, old friends of mine, college friends of mine, say, I had no idea you were doing all that stuff, because it was very, very furtive. But I think to the degree it was furtive, it was compulsive. And I actually had a psychiatrist once, a woman psychiatrist, whom I don't write about in this book, but who was rather a good psychiatrist, and she said to me, you're not really going to be able to liberate yourself from this kind of compulsive sexuality until you start coming out to a few of your friends, to your family.
So you did it little by little.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you lost your youth, though, because you felt so illicit every time you had sex with a man?
I think I suffered terribly, and some people have criticized this book for being self-pitying, but I think actually that there's not that much self-pitying. There's a lot of humor in the book. I think if I were to have put in all the anguish I actually felt, it would absolutely drown the reader. I'm 48 now, and I feel that if there's some sort of God, that he made the first half of my life absolutely miserable and the second half absolutely wonderful. I mean, at least since I've been 30, I think I'm the happiest person I know. But before that, I was one of the most unhappy.
What made your guilt go away?
I think it was, in fact, coming out. I think it was having a more integrated sense of self. For me, the final step was actually working on the book, The Joy of Gay Sex, which at the time, I wasn't a known writer. The publishers were perfectly happy if I had signed a pseudonym. They didn't care whether I signed my real name or not. But for me to sign my real name to a book like that was a kind of final act of coming out, in the sense I knew there was no turning back after that, you know.
Do you, I know there's some sensitivity about this, but do you, since coming out was the thing that felt liberating for you, do you go around saying to other people who are gay and still closeted that they should come out, that it would, that you feel sure it would work for them?
No, I don't feel sure for everyone. I mean, I think that all other things being equal, it is a good thing to do. But I think that if you look at, in a broad way, at the kind of gay people who do come out, they usually do not live now in the same city in which they grew up, and they're usually financially independent. I mean, it's hard to come out because there are risks, and particularly in the whole atmosphere of AIDS backlash right now, there are even more risks.
Mm-hmm. My guest is writer Edmund White, author of The Beautiful Room is Empty and The Darker Proof, Stories from a Crisis. Did your guilt go away completely?
No, and I think that what I'm experiencing now and is something that many gay men are experiencing because of AIDS, which is a reawakening of feelings of guilt. I mean, I think that AIDS in a way has declassed many people. I mean, it shouldn't, and I think, in fact, most intelligent heterosexual people, in fact, take a very compassionate attitude toward it. But I think that Americans in general have guilty feelings about sex. I mean, whether they're straight or gay, I think it's part of their national puritanism. And I think, secondly, gay people of my generation, at least, had to go through so much junk in trying to come to terms with their homosexuality that those feelings are never completely resolved, and they can be easily reawakened.
You know what I think about when I think back to the 1950s? That was the start of the Black Civil Rights Movement, and I wonder if gay people were saying to each other at all back then, let's watch this movement. Maybe there's a lesson in this for us.
No, because I think that assumes that gay people saw themselves as a potential community, but in fact they saw themselves only as a diagnosis. And I think that what I try to show at the end of my book, The Beautiful Room is Empty, it ends with the Stonewall Uprising, which is the beginning of gay liberation, which comes rather late, that is 1969. And in the book, I try to show what were the other social movements of the period that had shaped this consciousness. One of them was bohemianism, in fact. That is, the whole kind of arty crowd in the 50s who were the beatniks, who were really the only nonconformist in this vast, gray, McCarthy era. And I think the second group was feminism, which emerged, modern feminism, which emerged in the 60s. And which said, your personal life is political. I mean, that is what you're feeling as an individual in your relationships with other individuals is not simply the subject matter for psychoanalysis. In other words, you needn't always change in order to accommodate the status quo. You can demand that the status quo change to accommodate you. And that became a very important step, I think, for gays. And then I think finally, when at the Stonewall Uprising, which I just by a series of accidents happened to be at that uprising, when we said, gay is good, and we were shouting it, we were all laughing because it was a sort of parody of the then very popular phrase, black is beautiful. But even as we were laughing, we were sort of hearing echoes of what we were saying, and we began to take it a little bit more seriously.
Yeah. You seemed, when I read that in the book, that description of you shouting, gay is good, you did it so sensitively and tentatively, like you felt a little odd.
Well, part of the strategy of this book was to show myself as I actually was, which is as a very conservative person, because my idea is that a potentially hostile reader even would be more liberal today than that character was then. And I wanted the reader to say, oh, come on, for Pete's sake, just drop all these problems and get on with your life. And so I wanted the reader to feel relieved at the end of the book when, in fact, the protagonist does finally speak out for himself and begin to think, to accept himself.
Well, let me ask you about your ideal reader. You once said that your ideal reader, when you're writing fiction, is a cultivated heterosexual woman in her 60s who knows English perfectly but is not American. Now, why are you writing to that woman?
Because in a way, it's a very good way of screening out any kind of automatic understanding or sympathy for your writing. In other words, if the point of writing is to reach a open-hearted and willing reader, but not a reader who's already inducted into your way of seeing things, then I thought, well, a woman, yes, somebody in a different generation, yes, and who knows English perfectly, so there's no problem in reading even my rather elaborate style, but someone who isn't an American, that is, doesn't have all the same brand names. I mean, one of the things I don't like about some of the post-minimalist writing that's going on today is that it's oftentimes, I think, simply a laundry list. I mean, you name all the brand names, you name the current jingles and television ads and so on, and everybody feels kind of warm and reassured, and they think that's realism. Well, I think it's not really rendering it's not rendering our life for foreigners, for instance. It's interesting for me, for instance, living in France, and I see French people puzzling over a lot of the new American novels, and they simply don't know what the references are.
Mm-hmm. So they're writing about it in a pop culture way instead of exploring depth of character.
That's right. Yeah. I think so.
You know, in looking at culture in general, and as I read your books, I keep getting faced with this question. How is it that there are these groups in life that have all shared a history of discrimination? Blacks and Jews and Hispanics and, you know, many immigrants. And yet they don't support each other now. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure that's entirely true. I mean, after all, Jesse Jackson is the only candidate for president who's actually met people who have AIDS, who's shaken hands with people who have AIDS. I mean, and in the old days, in the Black Panther days, if you consider that you would expect, if you were a sociologist, you would predict that a black working-class man would have a lot of problems in dealing with white middle-class gays. But in fact, Huey Newton, believe it or not, the leader of the Black Panthers, mm-hmm. came out very much in favor of the rights of gay men, as did, and he linked up with Jean Genet, the French homosexual writer, who toured America with the Panthers. So I'm not so sure that we all oppress each other. I mean, I think that obviously Spanish culture men, Latino men, grow up in a culture that does emphasize the macho. And it's, I think it takes a real leap of imagination and creativity for them to be able to understand the oppression of gay men. But I think some of them have taken that leap.
If that's true, though, why isn't the gay movement further along?
Well, I think the gay movement is doing pretty well, considering its actual numbers, which are fairly small. One of the heartening things I see in America now is that there used to be a real lesbian gay male split in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was and I think it was partly because lesbians could always unite with feminists, who are a vast army. I think 40% of the women in America believe more or less in feminist principles. So that's not a minority. That's a huge group of people. And lesbians had a very privileged position within that movement, whereas gay men never had a corresponding group. But now, what's interesting is that during the AIDS crisis, even though lesbians are the least personally affected in terms of their own health by AIDS, nevertheless, there's been a great deal of generosity, compassion, solidarity coming from the lesbian community toward the gay male community.
Yeah. My guest is writer Edmund White. He has two new books out now. His novel, The Beautiful Room is Empty, continues the autobiographically based story of a young man from the Midwest moving to New York and coming to terms with being gay. White has also contributed to a new book of short stories titled The Darker Proof, which features stories based in the AIDS crisis. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Edmund White, author of The Beautiful Room is Empty and The Darker Proof, Stories from a Crisis. I was just thinking that back in 1980, when you wrote States of Desire, and that was a city-by-city travel diary, really, describing the gay male life, the New York Times printed a somewhat negative review. And the composer, Ned Roram, wrote into the newspaper, and he chastised the Times editors for assigning blacks to review black issue books and women to do women's books and so on. And he wanted to know why a gay writer with a, you know, a sense of gay history and knowledge wasn't assigned to your review. Was he right? Is that the thing that you like? Do you want gay writers to review your works?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think that is necessarily a prerequisite, but I must say I find American male heterosexuals, intellectuals, peculiarly tradition-bound. I mean, for instance, this book of mine, The Beautiful Room is Empty, came out in England before it came out in America, and it received terrific reviews everywhere, and it went number one on the bestseller list. And all of the reviews by heterosexual men, I guess they were heterosexual. Anyway, nobody mentions their own sexuality. But here, if the man who reviews my book happens to be heterosexual, he'll spend a good third of the book, a good third of the review, establishing his own sexual credentials, which I find a big bore and not very civilized. it just seems to me really ridiculous. But a typical review in an American paper by a man will say, well, I found this really difficult to come to grips with, and I really had to struggle with this one, but in spite of my encumbering heterosexuality, I was able to somehow. Well, uh-huh. I find that absurd. I mean, for instance, like, we've all read Native Son by Richard Wright. We've read books by, if we're men, we've read books by women. If we're American, we've read books by Chinese. I mean, it's absurd to act as though it's so difficult to make this particular leap of imagination.
Yeah, there's more angst here about it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have separate interests, I mean this personally, in how the gay community responds to your work and then how the more straight media respond?
Well, I suppose any movement like the gay one has a lot of tiny elements and even a kind of lunatic fringe who are more militant than I'll ever be, or more separatist, or more something or other. Anyway, you can't pay too much attention to that. I mean, I don't. I have frequently been attacked by gay critics for things that I don't take too seriously.
Minutia, you mean?
Yeah. Or, for instance, like in the early days of the gay movement, it was considered very important for gay writers to always show gay life in a positive light and to present positive role models. Well, I think that's a rather Stalinist approach to literature. And I've only felt obliged to show gay life as it is, not as it should be. And
so are you? Do you feel that you must feel that pressure on you? Because, here's a movement obviously searching for political leaders.
Yes. Well, I think this new book, actually, The Beautiful Room is Empty, is my most politically progressive and maybe politically committed book that I've ever written. Because, as I say, in the early days of gay liberation, in the early 70s, I never paid much attention to the movement, because I felt like fiction shouldn't have to embody political principles. But now that the gay community is so in danger, and people are predicting that half of all the gay men living in the major cities in America will be dead in another 2 years, if that's true, and I certainly have lost my share of friends, it seems to me that gay experience is really in danger of being forgotten, wiped out. So it makes me, at least, write with a kind of new urgency.
Have you lost a lot of your friends?
Oh, yeah, over 20, including my best friend and my editor on this very book, in fact.
I'm sorry.
Well, thank you.
In this other book that you've done, the one you co-authored with Adam Mars Jones, the stories are all about people living with AIDS or the specter of AIDS.
Right.
And you almost never mention the word AIDS in the book.
Well, yeah, I think that the reason we did that was because we felt like one of the things we wanted to do is we felt that most of the coverage of AIDS that there's been up until now has been from the press, and it's usually been experts who may or may not be gay, but experts in their capacity as scientists or doctors talking about this as a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And what's been left out of the equation has been the personal side of it, what it actually feels like to live through all this. So we wanted to, both Adam Mars Jones, Adam's one of England's better young writers, I think, and he and I wanted to reclaim some of this territory for ordinary lives, because homosexuality, after all, is a word that was invented by a doctor in the 1860s, and ever since, it's been a subject that's been very medicalized, always under the precinct of psychiatrists and doctors and endocrinologists and God knows what. And one of the accomplishments of gay liberation was to roll this back and to make some space for ordinary people to lead their lives. But now, because of AIDS, the whole situation is in danger of being re-medicalized. Anyway, we didn't want to use the word AIDS because I think people have a whole set of automatic responses when they hear that word and see it, mm-hmm. and a little curtain descends in your mind and you know what you think. We wanted to keep things open. That's also the reason that I think we wanted to write short stories instead of novels about this subject. Because if you write a novel, it has a kind of inevitable trajectory which ends with the death of one or several of the characters. A novel about AIDS.
Yeah.
Whereas a short story is something that cuts into the subject at an odd angle and gets you in and out of it in a way that you can control, and that throws, we hope, some sort of odd and new light on the subject.
Yeah. I found that I had dreams about the story, so it must be working. My guest is writer Edmund White, author of The Beautiful Room is Empty and The Darker Proof, Stories from a Crisis. You're living in France now. Why did you go there?
Well, I went to Guggenheim, which took me there for the first year, and then after I got there, I got a wonderful job with Vogue magazine, which is really the best job I've ever had in the sense that it gives me the most free time to do my own writing. And yet still pays my rent. But I also find it's interesting to live in another country. I mean, Gertrude Stein said she liked living in Paris because she felt she was the only person who spoke English there, that it was her private language, and she had a new relationship to the language. I know I've never written in a simpler or more American way than since I've lived in France. I mean, when I lived in the States, I think I was always longing to be in Europe, so I used a lot of foreign words in a very elaborate kind of Jamesian style.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think that I'm living in France, things are becoming simpler and more American.
Was there any sense of relief in getting there to sort of be away from the way that this country looks and talks about AIDS? Was there any difference there?
Well, at first there was, because there were fewer cases, but now France has the most cases in Europe, and I've lost several friends since I've lived in Paris, and also I became active in a group that provides all kinds of services for AIDS patients in Paris. I was one of the people who founded the Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York, and then when I went to France, I got involved with this group called AID, A-I-D-E-S.
I know that AIDS is pushing so many people to think about what's important in life. Has that made you reorder your work at all?
Oh, yes. I mean, I feel like I work much more quickly now, simply, directly, I hope more sincerely. I'm now writing a biography of Jean Genet, and I see that even as part of my AIDS work, in the sense that if gay culture is in danger of being wiped out, I think it's important that a few monuments be left behind to the real geniuses. And I think that Genet is one of the two or three great writers of this century, and yet who's been curiously undervalued because he emerged in an atmosphere of scandal, both in France and in this country. And, you know, he was a Grove Press author and somehow linked in people's minds with Henry Miller and other dirty writers, D.H. Lawrence, quality lit but dirty. And the truth is that Genet, I think, along with Céline and Proust, is one of the three great stylists in French in this century. And one of these amazing people who really invented himself. I mean, in the sense that he didn't begin writing until he was in his 30s. He was a prisoner. He'd been a prisoner or in and out of prisons most of his life. And suddenly he erupted into print with this fantastic stuff, which is not the kind of simple, naive writing that you would expect from a prisoner, but in fact some of the most elaborate and beautiful prose of this century.
And so that's inspiring to you.
Yes, very much.
Well, I hope it goes well for you.
Thank you.
My guest has been writer Ed White. His new novel is titled The Beautiful Room is Empty. It's published by Knopf. He and writer Adams Mars Jones are featured in a new book of short stories set in the era of AIDS. It's titled The Darker Proof, and it's published by New American Library. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air.